From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Rock Hudson's double life as a Hollywood heartthrob and a closeted gay man. Early in his career, he was known as the Beefcake Baron.
Because so many of the publicity images would show him shirtless, whether it was broiling a steak with his shirt off or fixing his car with his shirt off.
Hudson was a leading man in the 50s and 60s. Off screen, in his public life, he had to play the part of a heterosexual, or else his career would have been ruined. We talk with Mark Griffin, author of a new biography of Hudson. When Hudson died of AIDS early in the epidemic, it was a turning point in public awareness of the crisis, and it outed him.
Ironically, he was suddenly the hero of thousands of gay men.
And David Bianculli reviews season 2 of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That's on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It used to be unthinkable for a Hollywood star to come out as gay. But if you stayed in the closet, you could be blackmailed. Gay celebrities often face serious personal consequences for being forced to live a double life. A good example of that is Rock Hudson. In the 1950s and 60s, he was considered an all-American hetero heartthrob, the leading man in romantic melodramas like All That Heaven Allows and Magnificent Obsession, and romantic comedies like Pillow Talk and Lover Come Back. He starred with James Dean and Elizabeth Taylor in the film Giant. In the 70s, he starred in the TV series McMillan and Wife as the police commissioner of San Francisco. His secret was successfully concealed from the public until he was dying of causes related to AIDS. In 1985, he died at the age of 59. It was a turning point in the public awareness of the AIDS epidemic. As playwright William Hoffman put it, Hudson's death made people realize AIDS is a disease, not a moral affliction. My guest, Mark Griffin, is the author of a new biography of Rock Hudson called All That Heaven Allows. Griffin's previous book was a biography of film director Vincent Minnelli. Mark Griffin, welcome to Fresh Air. Reading your book about Rock Hudson, I was thinking how painful it must have been for him to be one of Hollywood's leading men, one of the most, quote, eligible bachelors, while being a closeted gay man. Do you have any insights into, like, the emotional distress it must have caused him to have to hide who he really was?
It's really interesting that if you read or look at interviews that Rock conducted over a long span of time, many decades, this one particular phrase, as I mentioned in the book, keeps coming up. I just learned to keep my mouth shut. This was, even as a young man, this was the beginning of Rock Hudson's life as a covert operation, if you will. So much of his life had to be interior, and he didn't feel free to express so much the fact that he had these great ambitions to be an actor. He never told any of his closest friends back in Winnetka, Illinois about that. And similarly, you know, all these issues in reference to his sexuality were certainly something that today we have these dialogues very freely about issues of sexuality. But back in the 1940s and the 1950s, when Rock was arriving on the scene in Hollywood, it was a very different culture, as we know. And all of that was repressed, and he could not say any of that aloud.
Well, it sounds, judging from your book, it sounds like even when he was growing up, his stepfather would punish him anytime the stepfather thought that any gesture or activity that Rock Hudson, who was then Roy Fitzgerald, was engaging in, was at all effeminate. So he learned early on to act straight.
Right. Most people assume that this reconditioning of Roy Fitzgerald, former truck driver from Winnetka, Illinois, into this Hollywood Adonis began when he met his notorious but very influential agent, Henry Wilson. But as you mentioned, it actually started years earlier. Sadly, Rock did have this abusive alcoholic stepfather, Wallace Fitzgerald, who was a former Marine. And Rock tells this sort of tragic story that when he built up the courage to tell his stepfather that he had these ambitions to be an actor, his stepfather hit him. And not only that, but I think confiscated any toys that he thought were in some way effeminate and discouraged any theatrical ambitions that Rock may have had.
When Rock Hudson was still Roy Fitzgerald, he was discovered by Henry Wilson, who was also gay.
Mm-hmm.
What was Henry Wilson's role in Hollywood?
He was a very influential figure in Hollywood, which is interesting when you think, you know, here's a gay man who was, I wouldn't say overt, but he wasn't as closeted as some of the actors had to be. And he managed this platoon of sort of B-list hunks that we're now very familiar with. And this would include not only Rock, but Tab Hunter, Rory Calhoun, Clint Walker. There was just a whole slew of them. And Henry, unfortunately, did not have the most sterling reputation in the industry. I think it was fairly well known that if you were a Henry Wilson client as Tony Curtis once expressed it, you probably had to sexually express yourself to Henry. So, you know, here's sort of the flip side of the Me Too movement. It's the gay casting couch, if you will. And when Rock first met Henry Wilson, this is basically one of the first contacts that he had into Hollywood. There had been a previous mentor, Ken Hodge, that Rock had been briefly involved with, and he had some contacts in Hollywood. But really, it was Henry Wilson who not only discovered Rock, but kind of cultivated this whole matinee idol image for him. And there was a lot of reconditioning that happened. You know, they got him voice lessons with a former opera singer. And, you know, I think there was a fair amount of butching him up so that he seemed matinee idol ready.
So just to clarify, was Henry Wilson an agent, a manager, a casting? Like, what was his official role?
He was an agent, and he had started in the business writing for some of the fan magazines of the time. And I think that sort of gave Henry Wilson an insider glimpse as to how to sell someone to the public. You know, so when he was writing profiles of movie stars, you know, oftentimes he didn't report exactly what he saw in front of him. He would redress it so that it was more palatable for the public.
How much did the agent Henry Wilson manage Rock Hudson's off-screen life to create the image in real life that Rock Hudson had on screen, you know, as this, you know, romantic, heterosexual, strong, heroic, romantic figure?
I think a fair degree of influence, and this was true not only of Rock, but many of the other actors that were in Henry Wilson's stable. And you can look at this two ways. You know, some people tell me, well, Henry is often painted as the arch villain of the story. But he could also be very supportive. A lot of these actors, for example, Guy Madison was a sailor, and Rory Calhoun was an ex-con, and Rock was a truck driver. So they didn't have any legitimate experience, and they were brought into the business simply because in the beginning they were so photogenic and so handsome and marketable that way. And I do think that Henry stage managed their lives to a great extent, particularly in the beginning before stardom really came calling. And I think that's especially true with Rock, who needed guidance, though later on he came to resent this and felt that Henry Wilson took too much credit for the star making and sort of was leaving Rock out of the equation in terms of his own success. You know, Rock said, well, there had to have been something there that I built upon initially, or none of this career would have happened. But it took a long time for Rock to leave Henry Wilson. I think that he felt that he needed him as a lifeline.
Did Wilson set Rock Hudson up with dates for to be seen in public so he'd look like, oh, he has such attractive girlfriends and what an exciting bachelor life he leads?
I do think that was Henry Wilson, and I also think that it's a little bit of a is the word conspiracy that I want to use. It's Universal as Rock Studio is having a hand in this. It's the fan magazines of the time, Photoplay, who want to present this particular image of Rock Hudson to the public. And it's, you know, Rock himself, of course, was a participant in this.
Can you give us an example of a magazine story about Rock Hudson that presented the illusion of Rock Hudson?
Well, the first example that comes to mind in terms of how Rock Hudson was sort of sold to the public, if you will, dates to the early 1950s. And Henry Wilson was influential in having Rock and Vera Ellen attend an event called the Hollywood Flash Bulbers Ball.
And I should just interject here. Vera Ellen was an actress who starred in some musicals like White Christmas and Words and Music.
Words and Music, yeah. She danced with Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. She had quite a career.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't enough for them just to attend this ball. Henry Wilson, I think, had the idea that they really needed to make a splash and be seen, presented as the perfect Hollywood couple at this event. And if you can believe it, he had them go dressed as Mr. and Mrs. Oscar. So they were slathered from head to toe in gold paint, sort of a la Goldfinger, and sort of appearing as living Oscar statuettes. And as you can well imagine, Luella Parsons was all over this, and there was a media frenzy, and pictures of Rock and Vera Ellen as the ideal Hollywood couple, actually outfitted as living Oscars, was splashed over newspapers all across the country the following day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Griffin, and he's the author of a new biography of Rock Hudson called All That Heaven Allows. We'll be right back after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Griffin. He's the author of a new biography of Rock Hudson that's called All That Heaven Allows. And it's not only about Rock Hudson's movies and how he became a leading man. A lot of it is about how Rock Hudson was closeted throughout his life and how that worked in Hollywood, how that worked for him and other gay actors. So magazines often presented an illusion of Rock Hudson, but some of the magazines were also very threatening to Rock Hudson and to other closeted actors in Hollywood because they could blackmail you. Was Rock Hudson ever blackmailed by one of the tabloids?
Yes, it came very close to that. The classic example of Rock being blackmailed or threatened is probably the better term, was Confidential Magazine, now very notorious. It launched in 1952. And I think the founder of the magazine, Robert Harrison, said that within a few years, it was being read by over 4 million people. And it was sort of the Access Hollywood, the TMZ of its day, and wielded a lot of influence, not in a positive way, unfortunately. And in 1954, the MGM actor Van Johnson was essentially outed by Confidential Magazine. They did sort of an expose on Van Johnson, who was a very popular actor of the time, and had a similar screen aura as Rock Hudson, sort of the boy next door and romantic leading man. So Henry Wilson caught wind of the fact that Confidential's editors were planning a similar expose on Rock. And Rock at that point was close to becoming one of the number one box office attractions in the world, and was certainly Henry Wilson's most important client. So Wilson had to do some fast acting to prevent this from happening. And as the story goes, he may have sacrificed both one of his current clients, Rory Calhoun, and a former client, Tab Hunter. He supposedly threw Calhoun and Hunter under the bus in the name of saving Rock's career. So I think it was in 1955, I believe it was, that there was suddenly a cover story that exposed the fact that Rory Calhoun had served time, that he had been an ex-con and had been involved with an armed robbery. And trying to remember the exact headline, but I think it said something like, "For the grace of God, still a convict, Rory Calhoun." And then just a few months later was another expose, this one probably more damning, and it was about Tab Hunter, the late Tab Hunter, who incidentally had fired Henry just a few months prior to this article appearing. And in this particular expose, they wrote that Tab had been involved in sort of an all-male pajama party that had been broken up by the police. So I think it's a pretty clear example of how Henry Wilson took a definite and very proactive interest in how he managed his clients, and Rock Hudson especially. Rock was very much his bread and butter at that point, the number one client, and on the rise in terms of his stardom. He was about to appear in maybe the most important film of his career, Giant. So that's an unfortunate example of how a gay man, Henry Wilson, would be willing to sell out another gay man, Tab Hunter, to save the career of a third gay man, Rock Hudson. So, interesting dynamic.
In setting up the story, you said supposedly, here's how the story goes. So are you like not sure whether Henry Wilson really did this or not, whether he really did sell out the other two actors to help Rock Hudson?
This is sort of the legend that has been passed down to us, the behind-the-scenes legend of how this played out. And it sounds very credible based on how we know that Henry Wilson operated within the industry. Do we have 100% certainty that that's exactly what happened? No, but I think we can make some pretty good educated guesses that that's exactly what happened in this instance. And the timing, particularly with Tab Hunter firing Henry Wilson just a few months prior, would lead us to pretty certainly believe that that's exactly how it played out.
And who's the we and the us that you're referring to?
Oh, the proverbial we. This story has been written in other books. It's been talked about in other documentaries. I think this is the accepted version, Terry, of what happened. But do I know that for 100% certainty? I would have to be honest and say no, but it sounds very plausible to me.
So do you think that most people in Hollywood who knew Rock Hudson understood that he was gay, but also understood that it was their job to keep his secret?
Yes, I think it was very much an open secret in Hollywood that all of the co-stars that Rock worked with, or certainly most of them, and directors and production folks knew that Rock was gay. And as one person expressed it to me, he was so kind to everyone that he worked with, whether that was the leading lady or the gaffer or the editor, that everyone sort of kept this secret for him. They knew that if he was exposed at that time, that would have just ended his career immediately. So it is sort of a conspiracy of silence, but it's interesting that they're doing this because they really love this person that they're working with and feel protective of him.
So Rock Hudson was married for 3 years to Phyllis Gates. Was that, what were you able to learn about? Because this is a kind of question that I still think exists. Was it a for real marriage? Was it a staged marriage? Did she know that he was gay? How much did she understand about that? What were you able to find out about that?
What's fascinating is you can talk to 20 different people about the marriage between Rock Hudson and Phyllis Gates and get 20 different versions of what each individual believes actually happened there. There's the one version of events where Henry Wilson, being very shrewd, knowing that not only Confidential but other gossip columnists of the time were sort of on to Rock and baiting him publicly, as we saw maybe in the Life magazine piece. So he knew that he had to get his number one client married quickly, and almost as though he sent out a casting call, he was looking for the perfect person to be the King of Hollywood's consort. And it just so happened that the ideal candidate was sitting right under his nose. Phyllis Gates was his then 30-year-old secretary. And she was really perfect casting. She was from Dawson, Minnesota. She had this sort of very engaging, fresh off the farm quality. She was a former Sunday school teacher, very photogenic. She had turned the head of the young Marlon Brando when they were both in New York City early on. So she was ideal. I mean, she sort of had the aura that you would want for a young woman who was going to be married to Rock Hudson. She sort of came with this air of county fairs and church socials about her. And so it could be that Henry Wilson very shrewdly put together Rock and his secretary, and a lot of people insist this is exactly how it happened. It was an arranged marriage from the get-go. Other people have suggested to me that, yes, in the beginning it may have been arranged, but ultimately and surprisingly, Rock and Phyllis may have developed some genuine feelings for one another. And if you read Phyllis Gates' 1987 memoir, My Husband Rock Hudson, sort of lays all of the blame for the disintegration of the marriage at Rock's feet, and also would like the reader to believe that she had been manipulated or duped both by Henry Wilson and Rock himself into participating in this sham marriage. A lot of people that I interviewed find it very surprising that Phyllis wouldn't have had some sort of clue about Rock's sexual proclivities, as she was working for Henry Wilson, top power broker in the industry. And if extras and bit players knew the score about Rock Hudson, why wouldn't she, being Henry Wilson's secretary? I interviewed this wonderful lady, Betty Abbott Griffin, who was a longtime script supervisor at Universal and one of Rock's dear friends. And I asked her about this, and she said, well, that was all totally arranged. And she seems like a very credible source to me. So I tend to believe that Phyllis did go into the marriage knowing fully well sort of what was expected of her, and that both Rock and Phyllis were doing this in the name of job security. But whether or not they actually developed some genuine feelings for one another, that I couldn't say. But some people have suggested that to me.
My guest is Mark Griffin, author of the new biography of Rock Hudson called All That Heaven Allows. We'll talk more after a break, and David Bianculli will review season 2 of the series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The first season won a bunch of Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from St. Martin's Press, publishers of Where Do We Go From Here? 2 Years in the Resistance by Senator Bernie Sanders, detailing his opposition to the current administration in the years since the 2016 election. And from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Capital One NA.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Mark Griffin, author of a new biography of Rock Hudson, who was a leading man, a heartthrob, in movies of the 50s and 60s, including melodramas like Magnificent Obsession and All That Heaven Allows, and romantic comedies like Pillow Talk and Lover Come Back. But he was forced to lead a double life because he was gay, and had the public known that, his career would have been over. He died of AIDS-related causes in 1985. When we left off, we were talking about his brief marriage to Phyllis Gates. When Phyllis Gates and Rock Hudson were divorcing, she hired a private detective, and he had somebody tape one of her conversations with Rock Hudson. And you transcribe this, because this became a pretty famous tape, I suppose, and it became described as Rock Hudson's gay confession. So I'm going to read an excerpt of the transcript of that. She says, "How long after we were married did you have your first homosexual affair?" And he says, "Oh, I don't know, the next day." And she says, "Can you deny that your pattern is that of a homosexual?" And Hudson, crying, says, "No, I can't deny it, but I never felt we were together on anything. I never felt you loved me." And I'm reading that excerpt because it's just kind of painful, the things he was leaving himself exposed to as, you know, a famous gay person who had to keep his identity hidden.
Yeah, that's very sad, and it's very poignant to hear that, and also to pair that with the knowledge that he didn't even know that he was being recorded at that moment. So he's sort of bearing his soul to this woman and doesn't know that this information is ultimately going to be used against him. And it's typical Rock, you know, he's always seems to be finding himself in a very vulnerable place and sort of not of his own doing. It's just for being who he is. You know, he's finding himself in these difficult situations.
I also feel like I have to bring up that she told the judge during the divorce hearings that Rock Hudson had struck her twice, both times after he'd been drinking heavily. I don't know if that's ever been substantiated, but, you know, that would be very disturbing, too.
It is. It is, particularly no matter from today's perspective or when
any perspective.
Supposedly,
yeah.
Exactly, yes.
Not good.
You know, they did have some pretty volatile arguments, Phyllis says in her memoir. Again, I wasn't there, so I can't comment. I can't say for certain that this happened or didn't happen. I would say this. It sounds pretty uncharacteristic of the Rock Hudson that I've gotten to know in researching his life in the last 4 years. When you talk to 100 people or more than 100 people and they all tell you something redeeming about your subject, that's pretty unusual. And I cannot tell you this whole cataloging of acts of kindness and good deeds that I heard from virtually everyone that I talked to. So these shocking anecdotes about him supposedly striking Phyllis after he had been drinking, it is disturbing, and it doesn't sort of square with the Rock Hudson that everyone has described to me. But again, I wasn't in the room with them, so I cannot for certain say that it did or did not happen.
In Pillow Talk, which is a romantic comedy where he stars opposite Doris Day, they share a party line, and she thinks that he's just a womanizer and has, like, a lot of disdain for him. And he kind of plays this practical joke on her in which he warns Doris Day that somebody else might actually be a gay man, the person who she's been, you know, flirting with and who she has this big crush on. And then, but that person, you explain it. It's complicated.
So in Pillow Talk, you have Rock is playing a womanizing songwriter, and he shares a party line, which I don't know if contemporary listeners will know what that is, right, where you share a telephone line with someone else and you're privy to some of their conversations. And it's basically like the plot of The Shop Around the Corner or the musical In the Good Old Summertime or You've Got Mail, where you have these two people who do not like each other because of shared circumstances. But then it turns out when they meet for the first time in person that they're actually enchanted with one another, yet they don't know that they are kind of rivals in this other area of their life. And so what's interesting is in Pillow Talk, as well as some of the other comedies that Rock made with Doris Day, like Lover Come Back, which followed, it's a house of mirrors. You have a gay man, Rock Hudson, playing a straight man. I think the character's name is Brad Allen in Pillow Talk, who's then in turn playing or impersonating a gay man in order to woo Doris's character. Sort of this backward thinking that by presenting the character as this kind of girl-shy, nebbish, that she's going to do her best in the name of heterosexual relations to seduce him. And that's how he will sort of cleverly win Doris Day over. I don't know if that I did a better job of explaining the plot there, but this becomes sort of the tenet of a lot of these comedies, not only the ones with Doris Day, but later with Gina Lollobrigida or co-stars like Leslie Caron, where oddly and ironically, Rock is playing a character who's masquerading as a gay man in order to seduce a woman. So you have to wonder, Rock was a very intelligent man, what is going on in his mind when he's being handed these scripts? And of course, he plays it all very adeptly and shows a wonderful flair for comedy in all of these movies. But you just have to wonder, as an actual gay man, you know, how is he processing all of this? And is it having any sort of impact on him psychologically or emotionally? The answer to that, I do not know, but I'd be very curious as to what he thought of all of that.
Yeah, me too. Let's just hear that scene where he's impersonating being gay. So here he is, here's Rock Hudson and Doris Day in a scene from Pillow Talk.
Tell me about your job. Must be very exciting working with all them colors and fabrics and all.
Rex. Would you like some dip?
I'd love to. Thank you. Tasty. Wonder if I could get the recipe. Sure would like to surprise my ma when I go back home.
And what's really just so difficult about that scene is not only is Rock Hudson straight impersonating being gay in that, but it's all based on gay stereotypes of, you know, like, he's too attached to his mother. He drinks with his pinky up.
Right.
You know, he's shy around women. So, yeah, I'd love to know what was going through his mind during that. Let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Griffin, and he's the author of a new biography of Rock Hudson called All That Heaven Allows. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pajamagram Company, offering 26 matching holiday pajamas for the whole family, including dogs and cats, with Snoopy, Star Wars, and Saint Nick themes in knits, fleece, and flannel. Learn more at pajamagram.com. And from Stars, with the original series counterpart. Season 2 finds Howard and his counterpart, both played by J.K. Simmons, stranded in the other's parallel dimension. Counterpart premieres this Sunday on Stars and the Stars app.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Griffin, author of a new biography of Rock Hudson called All That Heaven Allows. And it's about his movies and his place in Hollywood as a leading man in action films and a romantic leading man in dramas and romantic comedies. But it's also about how he was gay and what it was like for him as a closeted gay man in Hollywood. And it offers a lot of insights into what Hollywood was like for other gay men in Hollywood at the time. Rock Hudson died of causes related to AIDS, and he has a big place in the history of the AIDS epidemic. Is it fair to say he's the first, like, really, really famous person to die of AIDS?
Yes, I think it is fair to say first high-profile celebrity that acknowledged that they had AIDS and that,
yes,
in fact,
well
he was
put.
Dying of it.
Yeah. Mm. When did he learn he had AIDS?
In June of 1984 is when he received the official diagnosis. He had gone to a dermatologist to kind of have this pimple or blemish on his neck looked at, and that turned out to be, sadly, Kaposi sarcoma. And that's when he received this news, and he later told a friend that he cried for a week and was devastated by receiving what was at that time, you know, basically a death sentence. And it's interesting, the late great journalist Randy Schiltz, who wrote that terrific book And the Band Played On, probably expressed
about
it
the early days of the AIDS epidemic.
Yes, thank you. He said there was AIDS before Rock Hudson and there was AIDS after. And I think that what he was getting at there is the fact that it took a high-profile celebrity, a beloved movie icon like Rock Hudson, to finally get the public and I think we can say the Reagan administration to wake up to the fact that there was a global pandemic going on and that lots of people were dying. And after Rock's AIDS diagnosis was announced, I think in July of 1985, suddenly the epidemic was on the front pages of every daily newspaper in the country, whereas previously it had been reported as this mysterious cancer that was afflicting homosexual men and also some Haitians and drug users. And one thing I wanted to note at the beginning of 1985, which is the same year that Rock died, I think there were approximately 5,500 individuals that had died of AIDS-related causes, and yet the administration in Washington...
The Reagan administration.
Reagan administration, yes, had recommended a $10 million cut in AIDS spending in the federal budget. And after Hudson's death, there was suddenly this about-face, and the House of Representatives announced that it was doubling its AIDS-related funding and allotting, I think, $190 million to HIV education and prevention efforts. So it shows you the power not only of celebrity, but of Rock Hudson's particular celebrity, that, you know, he had been so beloved by so many people that thought of him as the boy next door. If Rock Hudson can get AIDS, then anybody can get it. And if he can get it, why don't we know more about it and why aren't we doing something about it?
It's interesting that President Reagan, who for a long time had, you know, paid, I think it's fair to say, virtually no or very little attention to the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. I assume he knew Rock Hudson because Rock Hudson had played opposite Jane Wyman in a couple of films, and Jane Wyman had been married. Jane Wyman was Ronald Reagan's first wife before Nancy Reagan.
Right, and I think Rock was friends of both Ronald and Nancy Reagan. I don't know how close, but he attended state dinners at the White House, and there are lots of photos that you can see on the internet, for example, of Rock posing with them, and not all that long before he died. One other interesting thing to note, I think it was in 1987, which is a full 2 years after Rock's death, President Reagan finally offered a public address concerning AIDS. And that was at the urging of Rock's great friend and his giant leading lady, Elizabeth Taylor. And by that time, there was 36,000 people, I think it was, that had been diagnosed with AIDS. And Elizabeth had become the national chairperson of the American Foundation for AIDS Research, or AMFAR. But one wonders now what would have happened had she not become so visible in the battle against AIDS, and had she not made this heartfelt personal appeal to the president, would that sort of, I guess you could say, head-in-the-sand indifference have continued within the administration?
Was it HIV that actually outed Rock Hudson?
Well, this is interesting. Yanou Kalor is the French publicist and a friend of Rock's who actually made this announcement outside of the American Hospital of Paris that Rock was battling the disease. And so now, retrospectively, I think the phrase that's often used is that it was more of an inadvertent outing. There was never any direct statement from Rock or any of his publicists saying, you know, I am a gay man. I think most people connected the dots. Well, AIDS diagnosis, we've heard some of these rumors about Rock and Jim Nabors. If you connect the dots, it can only lead to one conclusion. And what is very poignant is Rock believed that once this disclosure about his AIDS diagnosis was made to the public, that the public would completely turn their backs on him. And in fact, he received, I think it was 30,000 letters of support from, you know, the general public, moviegoers, people that had grown up loving him and seeing him in the movies. And but there never was this direct declaration about his sexuality. I think that's an important thing that we need to point out.
Do you think that Rock Hudson's story is an important part, not only of Hollywood history, but of gay history?
Absolutely. And not only because of the AIDS part of his story, but I think there's, in a sense, he is a reluctant role model, if we want to use that term, that when this situation occurred in 1985, where he divulged that he had the AIDS diagnosis, ironically, he was suddenly the hero of thousands of gay men. You know, this was the most public and beloved person that they had as a role model that they could point to. And it's interesting, in the 70s, the writer Armistead Maupin, famous for Tales of the City, was encouraging Rock to come out. This was back in 1976, 1977, somewhere in there. And there were a lot of people in Rock's entourage, his advisors, even his companion at the time, Tom Clark, who were discouraging this. But I think at one point, Rock may have even seriously entertained the notion of coming out. Came close, but didn't quite get there. It would have been remarkable, if not miraculous, if he had done so back in the 70s.
So Rock Hudson was a movie star. Do you think he was a good actor?
I do, and I think as time wore on, he got better and better as he got older. And what's a little bit sad to me is that just as he was hitting his stride as an actor in a film like Seconds, sort of his time as a leading man was running up, and the big movies, you know, he was could no longer be presented as the great matinee idol. So I think just as he was finding his niche and really, really becoming a great, committed, dramatic actor, it was time for him to transition to television and Macmillan and Wife, and that opened up a whole new avenue for him. But I think he was an underrated actor, as Doris Day was, actually, too. I think they were very versatile and skillful and deserve a lot more credit. And it's amazing to me that Rock only had the one Oscar nomination for Giant.
Since we are approaching Christmas, do you have a favorite Christmas film? I figure you've seen a gazillion films over the years. And I'm going to guess which one it is, and I'm going to guess that it's Meet Me in St. Louis, because your previous book was about Vincent Minnelli, who
right on the money
directed
yes.
it. and it stars Judy Garland and has great songs in it, like Have
and
Yourself
fact,
a Merry Little Christmas.
Exactly. That's the movie that introduced that timeless Christmas classic. And it's interesting that that is a movie that gets shown around the holidays, even though it's just one segment of it is set at Christmas time. But it is so indelible and it's so beautifully directed. Meet Me in St. Louis is a particular favorite of mine, and it's one that I think everyone should. It's a great family film, too, and it's about family at the turn of the century and how they come through all of these little crises that befall their household. And sumptuously produced and, of course, beautifully directed by Vincent Minnelli.
Mark Griffin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's been a great pleasure. I appreciate it.
Mark Griffin is the author of a new biography of Rock Hudson called All That Heaven Allows. After we take a short break, David Bianculli will review season 2 of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The first season won the Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. This year at the Emmy Awards, one of the major surprise winners was the Amazon streaming series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which won for Outstanding Comedy Series, Comedy Writing, Best Supporting Actress, and Best Actress. Season 2 of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel arrives on Amazon today, and our TV critic David Bianculli says the show deserved every Emmy it won. Here's his review.
The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel feels like several of my favorite TV shows in one. It's the best-looking and most believable period series since Mad Men, with settings, costumes, and characters you love spending time with. It's got the rapid-fire, high-intelligence dialogue of Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing, or, more specifically, The Gilmore Girls, since the creators of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino, also teamed on that show. And it's telling a story set in the late 1950s that's perfect for today as well, the story of a woman finding her own voice. In this thoroughly delightful sitcom, the woman is well-to-do New York housewife Midge Maisel, whose husband leaves her for his teenage secretary. Midge responds by voicing her anger in a new venue as a nightclub comic. Women comics were rare then, especially a woman who, like Lenny Bruce, who befriends Midge early on, speaks her mind and speaks very frankly. Midge is played by Rachel Brosnahan, who won an Emmy for her season one performance, and it's easy to see why.
Anyhow, Lolita found out, and boy, was she steamed. She couldn't believe I'd have the nerve to sleep with my husband. She thought that was mean and vindictive. And she has a point. After all, she has a teddy bear he won for her at Coney Island. And all I've got is a wedding ring and two kids who call him daddy. Who cares?
For season two, which launches on Amazon this week, Midge Maisel is at the start of her upwards trajectory as a comic. But her personal life is harder to predict or track because it's all over the place. She's flirting with going back to her husband, at the same time she's determined to leave him behind. And her parents are so shaken by her choices that they're making big, unexpected decisions as well. Maren Hinkle plays Midge's conflicted mother, Tony Shalhoub plays her distracted father, and the new season gives these two supporting actors more screen time, which they deserve. Like the star of this show, they nail every scene they're in. Here's Brosnahan as Midge, questioning her father about her mother's sudden disappearance. It leads to a flashback memory in which the father, Abe, played by Shalhoub, reads a newspaper at the breakfast table while his wife, played by Hinkle, speaks.
Papa, think hard. When Mama said she was going to Paris, what exactly did she say?
I don't know.
Concentrate. Recreate the moment.
I was there, and she came in, and...
I'm going to Paris. I don't feel like I have a life here anymore. Everything and everyone that I always counted on has let me down. I don't know what my place is here. You don't need me. Miriam doesn't need me. I serve no purpose. I'm unhappy, and I'm tired of being unhappy, so I book myself a flight for tomorrow night. Zelda's making lamb for dinner.
Lamb's good.
Papa, are you kidding me?
What?
Mama moved to Paris.
What? Oh, that's ridiculous.
Did you hear what you just said?
What?
You just told me that Mama told you she was moving to Paris.
I never said that.
I don't feel like I have a life here. Everyone and everything that I have ever counted on has let me down, and you said, okay.
No, I said lamb was okay, and it was.
Oh, good grief. Honestly, Papa, you don't listen.
Not true.
You don't listen to anyone.
Not true.
I don't feel like I have a life
Stop
here.
Stop repeating that. All right, I'll admit that sometimes I tune people out, but mostly because they rarely have anything useful or interesting to say.
Because of this, it's only a few minutes into the new season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel before we're off to a new country. Midge and her dad fly to Paris to retrieve Midge's mom. And while that visit leads to lots of hilarity, it also leads to some mother and daughter dialogue that hits very close to home.
Mama, listen to me. You have to get over this. The world is full of disappointments, and sometimes people let you down. You can't just run away.
What are you getting so upset about?
You made a commitment to this man. He is your husband. You have to go back to him.
Well, look who's talking.
The actors playing the parents are great and are written as complete, independently funny characters. A carryover approach from the Gilmore Girls. But complete characters are the rule, not the exception here. Michael Zegan, as Midge's unfaithful husband Joel, is written and played as confused and conflicted, not as a typical 1950s sexist cad. And his parents are interesting, too. Luke Kirby gets even more time in season two as Lenny Bruce, one of the occasional real-life comics portrayed in this series. And Alex Borstein, as Midge's devoted manager Susie Meyerson, is as good with a one-liner as her client, and earned her Emmy. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, an hour-long comedy of the highest caliber, deserves lots of Emmys. And for season two, deserves a lot more viewers also.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and co-editor with Doug Howard of Television Finales, From Howdy Doody to Girls, a new collection of essays from Syracuse University Press. Tomorrow on Fresh Air...
Hi, I'm Ben, and I'm an addict.
My guest will be Lucas Hedges, who stars in the new film Ben is Back, which was written and directed by his father. He's also in the new films Boy Erased and Mid-90s, and co-starred in Lady Bird and Manchester by the Sea. We'll also feature part two of our interview with Samin Nosrat, whose cookbook Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat has been adapted into a Netflix series. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Little Passports, a monthly subscription service for kids. Each package includes games, souvenirs, and activities from a new country designed to spark curiosity in cultures around the globe at littlepassports.com/radio. And from Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide to help customers find tires that fit their car and driving conditions. With a network of more than 7,000 independent installers, TireRack.com. Helping drivers find, deliver, install.